Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Roddy Nickpour. Today, we take you to the University of Maine in Orono for the 2018 Mitchell Lecture on Sustainability. We're delighted to hear from George Mitchell himself, for whom the event is named. He served as Maine's U.S. Senator from 1980 to 1995, and he joins us for a talk titled Healing Our Democracy. He looks at the divides in both Maine and across the United States. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and this program will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to find this program again at your convenience, and you can access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. You can also find it as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Joan Farini-Mundi, President of the University of Maine.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's my great pleasure to welcome you to the Mitchell Lecture on Sustainability. This is one of the premier events of our academic calendar and signals the University of Maine's great dedication to tackling sustainability challenges in and beyond Maine. And we are very fortunate to have Senator George Mitchell here with us today to give this address. We greatly appreciate his strong support of the Mitchell Center for Sustainability Solutions, for the entire University of Maine community, for the Mitchell Scholars Program, and for the education of Maine students. As you just heard, I arrived at the University of Maine quite recently, and it has been particularly exciting for me to learn more about the role that sustainability research, education, and outreach are playing, and the many ways in which our faculty and students have helped this institution become a national and global leader in this critical area. This commitment to university-community partnerships, interdisciplinary collaboration, and especially to solutions is the essence of what it means to be a trailblazing land and sea grant university in the 21st century. Central to this commitment is the Mitchell Center's growing reputation as a source of credible, independent, nonpartisan information to help create a brighter economic, social, and environmental future in and beyond Maine. Each year, we select a University of Maine student to introduce Senator Mitchell at the lecture, one who exemplifies both the vision of what the Mitchell Center should be and the values that Senator Mitchell holds dear. This year, I'm honored to introduce Bree Berry, a doctoral student in anthropology and environmental policy. Bree truly embodies the Mitchell Center's commitment to partnerships and collaborations in seeking solutions to sustainability problems and Senator Mitchell's commitment to the importance of public service. Bree's interest in sustainability was sparked during the 2 years that she spent in a rural area of the West African Republic of Mali as a Peace Corps volunteer. She worked there as an agricultural extension volunteer, providing support to communities doing composting, fish farming, and ecotourism. The strong culture of reuse in Mali made Bree question her own practices, and she spent the next 8 years exploring various aspects of sustainability and gaining more and more diverse experiences. Those included studying for a master's degree in urban sustainability studies at City University of New York's Hunter's College, coordinating outreach activities for New York City's Zero Waste Schools Initiative, working as an energy analyst for Energy Investment Systems, and providing environmental education for activities for the Central Park Conservancy. It was those experiences that provided the foundation for her current research at the University of Maine on Maine's reuse economy, and that led her to deep connection with the Mitchell Center. So now it's time to turn the podium over to Bree, who will introduce Senator Mitchell. Thank you.
Okay, Senator Mitchell, you might not know this, but we've been spending a lot of time together over the past couple of weeks. As I've been thinking about how I would construct this introduction, I take out this book, and we sort of talk it out together. It's no small pressure to introduce one of Maine's great leaders, especially for someone like me who is not from Maine. You're not just a senator, but the Senate Majority Leader. Not just a negotiator, but the primary architect of the 1998 Good Friday Agreement for Peace in Northern Ireland. And I could go on. In your book, you write about how lucky you are to be rooted in Maine, and I can see why. Although I've only lived in Maine for just over 2 years, I can see what makes you cherish it so much. So I'm going to do my best here and hope that you'll all forgive me if this introduction is not up to snuff. So on my very first day on campus here at the University of Maine, just days after I quit my job in New York City and drove to Maine with my husband, two cats, and all of our belongings, I stepped foot in the Senator George J. Mitchell Center for Sustainability Solutions. I was invited to a meeting with a group that I've now been involved with for over 2 years, an interdisciplinary team dedicated to connecting research to action on issues associated with waste management in Maine. The Mitchell Center has been a home for me for over the past 2 years. It's taught me the powerful role that universities can play when they work collaboratively with community partners. It's taught me how to tackle big, messy sustainability problems. These problems tend to be wicked in that they have multiple causes, they're hard to define and harder to measure, and they involve a lot of moving parts that tend to affect one another. As I've learned at the Mitchell Center, to take on these sustainability challenges, you have to take risks and try new things. You have to listen carefully and not be so fond of the sound of your own voice that you block out alternative ideas and solutions. Above all, you have to have patience and the willingness to put the time and effort in to work with community partners, because the process will be stronger if it's deliberative and inclusive. I'm using those skills that I learned at the Mitchell Center in my own research, which focuses on reuse here in the state of Maine. As part of this interdisciplinary team at the Mitchell Center, I'm thinking about how we can extend the lifespans of material goods so that they can be kept out of landfills and incinerators. It turns out that Maine is a great place to study reuse. It seems like everyone I meet has a story about something they found at a yard sale, or a swap shop, or an antique store, or a neighbor's barn. You get the idea. Because the Mitchell Center taught me that sustainability problems are multidimensional, I'm thinking about more than just the environmental aspects of reuse, but also its social impacts, particularly for those small Maine towns that have gone through drastic economic changes over the last few decades. We often talk about not one, but two Maines, and whether we think about the divide as rural-urban, north-south, or coastal-inland, the division speaks to the idea of those who have and those who don't. My research looks at the places that seem like they don't have much going for them and asks what we might not be seeing or measuring. Today we're going to hear Senator Mitchell speak about healing our democracy and about divisions in the state and across the country. I think that some of that healing can come from institutions like the Mitchell Center, a place with a strong commitment to public service that extends to the entire state, to both of the two Maines. Senator Mitchell, I know we've never met, but I feel like I know you because I've gotten to know the Mitchell Center. Your values, ethic of public service, and leadership are in the bones of the Mitchell Center. It's no coincidence that the skills you use to lead the state and the country through so many contentious challenges, listening, patience, risk-taking, and service, are central aspects of the work that is being done and being taught in the center that bears your name. I can tell you and those in this audience that the values that guided your career are continued in the work that the Mitchell Center does every day. Please join me in welcoming Senator Mitchell to the stage.
Thank you. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for being here and for your warm reception. My thanks to Bree for that really wonderful introduction. I'm pleased that we're joined by President Joan Farini Monday. Also here is our former president, Sue Hunter. Welcome, Sue. It's great to see you as well. And I... I want to also acknowledge the presence of David Hart, who spoke, and the staff at the Mitchell Center here who do such an outstanding job. Please join me in recognizing their contribution. Thank you, David. I was recently on the campus for another event and drove by the field house and there saw again the baseball batting pavilion named after my brother Paul, who was a graduate of this university. And it generated bittersweet thoughts about our lives together. And on Saturday, I will return to Waterville to open a public park in the area where I grew up with my brothers and our family. It was then an industrial slum area for immigrant workers in the textile mills. It's now been cleared, and the city of Waterville has built a very lovely park along the river. When I was a kid growing up, the river was the place you didn't want to be. It was filthy, terribly polluted and smelly, and a sign of taking a step up the ladder of American success was when you could afford to move away from the river. Things have kind of reversed now in a peculiar way, but it has made me bittersweet because my brother Paul passed away and won't be at the ceremony this Saturday, as did my brother Johnny. They were both wonderful to me, both great athletes and mentors. And I saw my brother Johnny just before he passed away, and he said to me that people live through the stories told about them, so please keep telling those stories about me long after I'm gone. Although my brother Paul died suddenly, I'm certain 100% that he would agree with that sentiment. So this is a long, serious talk I've got here, and I want to begin with a humorous story about growing up in Waterville and my brothers. The two of them and another brother, Robbie, were great athletes, went on to fame at the University of Maine and colleges around New England. And then I came along, and I was not as good an athlete as my brothers. In fact, I was not as good as anybody else's brother. So very early in my life, I became known around our small town as Johnny Mitchell's kid brother, the one who isn't any good. As you might expect, I developed a massive inferiority complex and a highly competitive attitude toward my brothers. So many years later, unexpectedly, I was a federal judge presiding in Bangor, and Senator Muskie was appointed Secretary of State, and Governor Brennan named a successor. And the night before he was going to make his public announcement, he called me very late, about 11 o'clock, and said, I'd like you to come down to the state capitol in Augusta tomorrow so I can announce that I'm going to appoint you to the U.S. Senate. I said, Governor, this is a big, serious decision. I'm a federal judge. I really love the job. I got to think about it. I got to talk to my family. He said, I'll give you 1 hour. I protested it was insufficient. He held firm. 1 hour, you have to call me back in an hour. So I immediately called my three brothers on the phone. It was ostensibly to seek their advice, but there was a note of triumphalism in my voice. I said to them, guys, the governor just called. He wants to appoint me to the U.S. Senate. What do you think about that? The reactions were predictably negative. My brother Johnny said to me that you couldn't possibly win a statewide election. He said, nobody can understand how you got to be a federal judge. He said, so you better stay where you are. My brother Paul, who fancied himself an intellectual, liked to engage in conversation using the Socratic method of asking questions. So he said, I have a number of questions to ask you. First, he said, aren't the people of Maine entitled to have a qualified person representing them in the Senate? Yes, I said. Well, he said, isn't it obvious that you're not among them? No, I said. So I hung up, and I called the governor, and I said, Governor, I don't need an hour. I've already received all the reassurance I need for my ability to serve in this job. Now, after I left the Senate, I was asked many, many times, still to this day, I'm asked, well, what was the high point of your political life? People say, was it the peace in Northern Ireland, Senate Majority Leader, something else? And I tell them, no, the high point of my life was the day after I was elected to the Senate in my first election. It had been a difficult race. I was way behind, but I was lucky. I caught up and ended up winning. And on election evening, there was the typical hotel ballroom scene that you have seen on television many times. The crowd gathers, and when the race is called, the candidate comes down, and everybody claps, and the candidate gives an acceptance speech. So on that night, it was in a hotel ballroom in Portland. The room was packed, and after the race was called, I was brought down from a hotel room to come onto the stage and give my speech. But the stage was absolutely jammed with people. I could hardly move. And when I got to the lectern, my brother Johnny was standing there. He had elbowed my wife and daughter away from the cameras so that he could be there standing right in front of the microphone and the cameras focused on him. When I got there to give the speech, I couldn't get him to move. He just simply put his arms around me, and so I delivered my acceptance speech with my brother hanging on to me. So a little bit awkward, both physically and the arrangements. And the next day, the Portland paper had a big picture on the front page, Senator George Mitchell celebrating his upset election victory, being cheered on by an unidentified supporter. That was the high point, not just of my political life, but of my whole life.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Senator George Mitchell is speaking at the University of Maine in Orono about A Tale of Two Maines. He'll explore the factors that have created this division and how we can close the gap.
Well, I've talked often in Maine, including at every high school in the state at least once. The subject has varied widely, including my experiences growing up in Waterville, serving in the Senate, chairing the peace process in Northern Ireland, searching for peace in the Middle East, tackling the challenge of immigration, and many other issues. Today, I want to talk about the intersecting economic, social, and political challenges we face in this country and in the world, and what steps can be taken to tackle these challenges. In particular, today, I want to discuss the actions of local citizens and communities. My goal is to discuss what can be done here in Maine, to suggest how we can build from the ground up our capacity for solving problems through discussion and consensus building. Our state motto is I lead, and I hope in this effort, Maine can set an example for the nation. Because I'm speaking at a university, and because I believe in the power of higher education to transform lives, I also want to address the important role that universities and colleges can play in helping address these challenges. This is a time of social, economic, and political turmoil in Maine, in the United States, in the world. But it's not unprecedented. We sometimes forget or minimize the difficult conflicts of the past, and we tend to view history through rose-colored glasses. But when you remove those glasses, it's hard to find a time when there weren't strong political disagreements, widespread conflict based on different belief systems, different values, goals, and preferences. These differences are fundamental to human affairs and can lead to conflict even within families, in communities, as well as within and between nations. Especially in America, it's important to acknowledge that we are not and never have been a fully homogeneous society. As Maine's own author, Colin Woodward, has written in his award-winning book, American Nations, our country is a mixture of people from different backgrounds who came to America at different times for different reasons. Even in Maine, a state with one of the nation's highest proportion of citizens who identify as white, there are enough cultural and ethnic differences to give rise to conflict. Just think of the incredible journeys that have brought people to this proverbial melting pot, beginning, of course, with the people of the Dawn, better known to us as Native Americans, more than 10,000 years ago, followed just about 500 years ago by the French, the English, the Spanish, the Germans, the Scots-Irish, French-Canadian, African-American, Italians, Jews, Hispanics, Lebanese, Amish, Somali, and many others. A melting pot implies the presence of heat, and many racial and ethnic groups have experienced enormous friction and hostility in their efforts to build a better life in America. Of course, we are all painfully aware that Africans were the one group who came to America involuntarily, in chains, and the racism and the discrimination they continued to suffer long after the Civil War brought a formal end to slavery. While white supremacists like the Ku Klux Klan often come to mind when we think of violence against North Americans in the latter part of the 19th century, it's important to remember that the Klan was very active in the North, including in Maine, just about a century ago. Here, however, in other parts of the North, their hostility was most often directed against recent Catholic and Jewish immigrants to our country. Of course, the political conflicts we're currently experiencing are not just about immigration. The well-being of our democracy has always depended on a balance of compelling but conflicting ideals, including individual liberty and collective security, opportunity for all, self-government, the rule of law. Americans have often disagreed about which of these ideals are most important at any given time, and how they should be balanced in public policies and everyday life. As we know, in our own lifetimes, when faced with external threat, the demands of collective security tend to rise in our estimation. Despite these disagreements, a majority of Americans share a common aspiration. Indeed, a majority of people all over the world, that our children and future generations will be better off than we have been. Although it may never be possible for every citizen to achieve this goal, I'm convinced it's worth striving for because it can serve as a source of common purpose as we wrestle with the complexities of how best to achieve it. One major fault line along which economic, social, and political disagreements are particularly conspicuous today is the one that separates rural and urban areas. Although this is not a new phenomenon, it is a growing concern. Throughout my political life, I've talked about the challenges of the two Maines. Although Maine is legendary for its spectacular coastline, rugged mountains, pristine lakes, and verdant forests, open space and natural beauty, a small consolation to the poor. The challenge facing us always has been how to make the two Maines one, to improve the lives of the people of the second Maine without destroying the things that make the first Maine such an attractive place to live. Today, looking back across several decades, I regret that life in some parts of Maine is even more difficult today than it was when I was a young boy, leading to declines in the well-being of many individuals, many families, many communities. As just one example, this is the first time in more than a century that there has not been any paper mill operating in the Penobscot River Basin. These mills were an important source of prosperity and well-being. More generally, the loss of factory and blue-collar jobs in Maine has eroded the foundation of many local and regional communities. It's important to remember that the force of technological innovation and globalization have long been with us. Nearly two centuries ago, stagecoaches were built in New England, but the industry disappeared following the development of railroads and automobiles. No rational person recommends that we return to the era of stagecoaches, but there is no doubt that many individuals, families, and communities were devastated by this innovation and change. The same is true today, whether we're talking about paper mills, shoe factories, the collapse of the cod fishery, changes in energy supplies, or the ways right now that brick and mortar stores are threatened by e-commerce. Despite many attempts by federal, state, and local governments, they have not been effective in helping the families and communities ravaged by factory closures, by the offshoring of industries, and by automation. Most of us here are beneficiaries of the technological changes that have rapidly developed in our recent lifetimes. But not very far from here and all across this state and this country, there are millions of people who are victims of those changes. There's a related but even more pervasive and troubling fault line dividing people in Maine and across America. For several decades, the average living standard of low and moderate income workers have remained stagnant or declined, while those of high income earners have risen dramatically. Although this trend began most recently in the 1980s, the disparity was magnified by the global recession that began in 2008 and whose adverse effects are still being felt today by millions of our fellow Americans. And during this same time frame, we've witnessed rising disparities among places and people in employment opportunity, as well as access to such essential resources as good health care, educational opportunity, and even sufficient food. Although there is not always a direct cause-effect relationship between rising inequality and the decline of the well-being of families and communities, there can be no doubt that inequality is a significant contributor. As these disparities have grown, and in part because of them, we also are seeing the rising influence of populist political movements. Not just in America, those involved claim popular support in the United Kingdom's vote to withdraw from the European Union, and the leadership actions being used to exalt individual leaders and stifle democracy in Hungary, Poland, and Turkey. Although there isn't any single definition that adequately describes all leaders who claim to be populist, they tend to adopt an us versus them view of the world. They often speak of their commitment to represent the downtrodden members of society, who they describe as victims of the elites who have allegedly corrupted the system. It's easy to paint a picture of the world in clear and stark terms of good versus evil, but the reality is almost always more complex, more nuanced, more difficult to comprehend and deal with. Populist rhetoric is particularly difficult in a pluralistic society like the United States, because it rejects the legitimacy of all but one group. In claiming to represent the will of the people, populists undermine the legitimacy of a wide range of views and values that inevitably exist in diverse societies. Given that America is rapidly becoming a minority-majority nation, where ethnic and racial minority groups will make up more than half the population, populism may sound persuasive in the short run, but it cannot possibly provide a roadmap to a brighter future that can be shared by all in our society. Along with most Americans, I'm deeply troubled by the toxic nature of our current political environment, in which many leaders are more focused on narrow partisan goals than on the broader public interest. Nevertheless, I remain hopeful that these challenges can be overcome if citizens, their representatives, and the courts focus on at least three steps: reducing the corrosive and often hidden influence of big money in politics. The American political process has been corrupted by money. Billions and billions of dollars are pouring into our political system, and in a parallel set of actions that produce the worst of all worlds, transparency has disappeared. There isn't a person in this room or in this country who knows who is giving what to whom in the election we're about to hold or in future elections. We must also minimize the use of gerrymandering, and we have to recognize that democracy cannot flourish unless there are many legitimate and competing ideals and values. Our political system, our economic system, our way of life, our sports are based on the premise that competition, fair and open competition, produces the best result. The strength and genius of America has always required equal measures of creativity and tolerance and persistence in the search for common ground. But we can and we must do more than just wait patiently for the spirit of collaboration and consensus building to return to Washington. There are several compelling reasons for Americans to roll up their sleeves and support democratic processes even more at the local level. First, there's no telling how soon things will be working better in Washington, and there's no time to lose in rekindling our democratic norms. Second, even when the federal government was functioning far more effectively than it is today, it has always been true that many of the challenges facing American families and communities are better addressed at the state or local level. Third, in strengthening our capacity to solve local problems, we can hone our democratic values and practices, which may enhance our ability to identify and send skilled leaders to Washington. Indeed, it's hard to imagine that there will ever be a spirit of open-mindedness and capacity for compromise in Washington if it has not first been cultivated in local communities all across the country. One of America's prominent philosophers, John Dewey, said that democracy begins in conversation. I believe it will be difficult to revitalize our democracy unless we significantly improve our ability to communicate, and most especially, our capacity for listening. We commonly assume that the most important ingredient in effective communication is the ability to express oneself clearly and persuasively. And I'm sure that many of you have gained considerable experience inside and outside the classroom in those skills and in writing for different audiences. They've been important in my own life. But when I think about what it takes to address some of today's most difficult challenges, I worry that each of us spends too much time focusing on expressing our own views and not enough time listening to and seeking to understand the views of others. Many of our society's problems can't be solved by a simple debate about the facts, because our disagreements aren't just about the facts. They're also about the marked differences between the values held by different individuals and groups, the complex tensions and trade-offs that make it so difficult to find any common ground. Our conflicts aren't just about what is, they're also, indeed most often, about what ought to be. And in America, there are deep differences about what ought to be. How can we make this a strength rather than a weakness? One of the most important skills that I needed to develop my own career was the ability to listen carefully to the views of others, not just to demonstrate my respect for them, for their values and belief systems, but to help me identify areas of common ground about what ought to be. In a world where it's easier than ever to be surrounded by others who think the same way you do, in your workplace, your neighborhood, or on social media, we need to redouble our efforts to hear and understand the views of those who think differently from us. We need to constantly ask, why do they believe as they do? Why do they act as they do? Is there something in their position that I don't understand or that I've been wrong about? I'm not a scientist, but I do know this. The human mind is receptive to views that are consistent with our prior beliefs. They come in readily, we retain them well, and we use them often. But for views that are contrary to our prior beliefs, they have to thread a needle, we don't retain them, and we don't use them. And that's reinforced by the deluge of electronic communications and the creation in recent years of highly partisan news delivery on television. It's not an easy habit to develop, listening. So I actually tried to practice it in the Senate. Each day I asked my staff to select several of the most negative letters I'd received from constituents. I read each one carefully, and then in the evening when the Senate was in session, I sat at my desk and I called on the phone each of these letter writers. Almost everyone I reached was surprised, and most of them doubted that it really was their senator calling. Once I convinced them the call was genuine, I told them that I'd read their letter and that while I understood that we disagreed, I welcomed their views and I appreciated the fact that they had taken time to write to me, and I assured them that I would give consideration to their views, although I could not assure them that I would ever agree with them. With a few exceptions, the conversations were polite and civil, and later, while traveling all across Maine, over and over again, I was approached by many people who had received such calls and wanted to meet me in person. Once I became Senate Majority Leader, I didn't have time for that, and I found out how much I missed the calls in my daily life. I hadn't received any formal training before I found myself in leadership roles where being a patient listener was an essential skill. Along the way, I gained on-the-job learning that proved invaluable for building concession with people who have different views and different values. And one of the nicest compliments I ever received was when one of the political leaders of Northern Ireland said of me that I had listened them to an agreement. As the need for these listening skills and collaborative approaches continues to rise, it's encouraging to see efforts underway in and beyond Maine to try to engage citizens in conversation with experts and decision makers as one step in building our capacity for shared problem solving. Although these initiatives go by many different names, deliberative democracy, collaborative problem solving, dispute resolution, participatory decision making, they have at their core the goal of strengthening our capacity to make decisions together. And really, when you think about it, isn't that one of the central goals of politics? It's particularly gratifying for me to know that many of the students and the faculties at the Mitchell Center for Sustainability Solutions have committed themselves to this important work. Helping partners in the Katahdin region to chart a new course for community and economic development, working with Clamors, town officials, and state agencies to enhance livelihoods linked to shell fishing, collaborating with the public and private sectors and non-governmental organizations to reduce food waste, and hunger among our children. Just a few weeks ago, the center hosted a productive visit and talk by a national leader in the movement known as deliberative democracy. Next week, two researchers who completed their doctoral dissertations here with support from the center, and they are Karen Beluck and Bridie McGreevy, will lead an innovative workshop to help students and faculty improve their skills in collaborative problem solving with stakeholders. In the spring, Linda Silka, a senior fellow at the center, received a Lifetime Achievement Award for her innovative work building university and community partnerships to help solve exactly these kinds of problems. One of the most innovative aspects of the center's work is the way it strives to serve as a safe space or a neutral ground where people with different backgrounds can come together to address common challenges. Indeed, the center has become a role model demonstrating how institutions of higher education, like this great university, can serve an invaluable role in society as a convener, a facilitator, a mediator of disputes. So it's fitting that this center is helping lead the way when it comes to healing our democracy, beginning in Maine. And I especially admire the center's dedication to promoting open communication and, critically in all these efforts, mutual respect. They're key ingredients in building trust. In my experience, these are essential steps in resolving conflicts, developing shared views and commitments, and increasing our collective capacity to solve problems. Of course, we cannot fix all the problems in our democracy through local efforts alone. Many legal, regulatory, and policy issues require a national approach. But there are important opportunities for citizens to engage more actively at the local level, and that can generate benefits for the nation as a whole. And it's particularly exciting to think about the ways in which students, who before we know it, will be our nation's leaders, are rolling up their sleeves to renew our civic practices and our institutions. We should not just applaud them, we should join them. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Senator George Mitchell will now answer questions from the audience.
Hi, Senator Mitchell. Thank you so much for being here today. You started off your speech by talking about the high point in your political career and your life in general. What would you describe as your low point in your political career, and what can we as a nation learn from it?
I've had so many low points, I could write a book about them. It's hard to choose which was lowest. I ran for governor in my first race, and I lost. That was hard to take, but what I would say to people, failure is inevitable in life. And at 8 o'clock the next morning, I showed up back at my law firm for work. I didn't take a break for about 3 or 4 months till I'd kind of gotten over the sting of defeat. And I think that a healthy message to everyone is that it is inevitable that you will fail at some things in your life. And the crucial test is whether you can recover from that, accept it, try to improve, and do better the next time. So that was a low point for me politically. Like all human beings, there have been family tragedies that are really much larger in the broad scheme of things in individual lives. That was a political setback. I had many failures. I'll tell you about another one. After I graduated from college, I served in the United States Army in Europe on active duty, and then I decided to go to law school. I didn't have any money, so I went to Georgetown University in Washington, in large part because it had a night school. So you could, I worked full-time during the day, and I went to law school in the evening. I did quite well, but when after I graduated, I wanted to come back to Maine to practice law. So I sent my resume to 15 law firms. 13 never replied. Two of them did. They granted me an interview, and then they politely informed me that they'd selected someone else. So I couldn't get a job with a law firm in Maine. In part, then there was a stigma, somewhat of a stigma associated with going to school at night. So I ended up, luckily, I had done well, and I, out of the blue, I got a letter from the Department of Justice offering me a job because I had scored high in my law school, and they offer a certain number of positions to graduates. I'd never heard of the program, but I benefited from it. But it took me 5 years after that to finally land a job with a law firm in Maine. So it was quite a low point when I couldn't get a job coming out of law school, but I stuck with it and ended up getting one. Just everybody fails. The only other message I would say, this has nothing to do with failure, but it's the other side of it. I think you have to be willing to take risks in life, to seize opportunity when it unexpectedly comes, as it almost certainly does in every human life, and to take a chance. And if you don't succeed in that, as I said, come back and try again.
Thank you very much for your remarks. You mentioned the pervasive and negative impact of money in politics, and this seems like an overwhelming issue for local people to deal with. Do you have any ideas on how we as a community, as a society, might approach that?
I said in my remarks that our political system has been corrupted. I did not mean that or intend it in the sense that there's a lot of Senator Hart, if you'll vote my way, I'll give you a bag full of cash. Our system is much more subtle and much more destructive than that. What I meant was that the current Supreme Court, in a series of decisions, the most prominent of which is known as the Citizens United case, has effectively said that we cannot constitutionally impose limits on political contributions to campaigns or expenditures by campaigns. And I believe that's wrong. I believe that not only can we must. And I'm going to demonstrate it now by a simple test. I've spoken across the past 10, 15 years to thousands, tens of thousands of people in audiences in virtually every state in this country. And I ask this question, how many here believe that our representatives in Congress are more responsive to their citizens than to their donors? Raise your hand. Well, that's the reaction I get all over America. In fact, only a handful of people have raised their hands. And the first one was a few years ago. I was in the Washington, D.C. area speaking to a large audience. I asked that question. One woman raised her hand. I was so taken aback. It was the first time anybody ever raised a hand that I didn't say anything. I didn't want to embarrass her. So I waited till the event was over. And I walked up to her and I said, look, I don't want to embarrass you, but you're the only person in America who's ever raised your hand on this question. Can you tell me why? She said, oh, it's simple. My husband's a member of Congress. That was it. Well, we all know what's happening. Billions and billions of dollars are being poured in. I urge every one of you to go on your computer and look at a segment of 60 Minutes on CBS that aired in April of 2016. It featured a Republican member of the House of Representatives from Tampa, Florida, a man named David Jolly. I've never met him. He described in detail the orientation process that he went through his first week as a member of the House of Representatives, and it was all about money. And to be fair, both parties do the same thing. He showed a card that he had with describing how to allocate his time each workday. And 4.5 hours raising money, 1 hour devoted to constituents, and 1 hour devoted to legislative work. Those are the priorities. And it's a shocking thing. I don't think members of Congress like it. And I know the public doesn't like it. So I think it's going to take a change in the Supreme Court, which will say that the earlier Supreme Court, which said we could impose limitations, was right, and this Supreme Court is wrong. That may be a long time off, but it has to change. And as I mentioned, parallel with the increase in money have been a series of unrelated steps, unrelated directly to the legal decisions, that have virtually eliminated transparency in funding of political campaigns in our country. The complex web of organizations and accountants and lawyers dedicated to this purpose have obscured it to the point where nobody knows and nobody can find out. And to me, that is corruption of democracy, which relies upon the trust of the people in their elected representatives and a reciprocal trust by the representatives in the people they represent.
One more.
We have time for one more question, so here you go.
Thank you, Senator Mitchell, for all you've done good for the world. I'm wondering what we could do to prod our media to cover more solutions for these problems instead of only the political circus that most of them are covering now, and how we can encourage other citizens to expand the media that they do read.
I'll tell you a story which will dishearten you. I spent 10 years in the Senate working on legislation which became known as the Clean Air Act. The initial legislation written by Senator Muskie covered almost exclusively automobile emissions. In a few years, it became evident that while that was a critical source of air pollution, there were many, many other sources. And what was being done with respect to automobiles was woefully inadequate. So we enacted in 1990 what was essentially a massive rewrite and expansion of the bill. As I said, it took 10 years. In the last year, we had a lengthy negotiation, which I and a couple of others, senators, led in behalf of the Senate and representatives of the President. There were many difficult issues. This took a very long time, but we narrowed them down. And as we got close to completion, the Washington Post printed a big story about the Clean Air Act, which focused almost entirely on the 2% of the issues that we had not yet resolved and ignored the 98% that we'd resolved. And so I confronted the reporter. I said, you know, you got 38 paragraphs about two issues, and they are tough, and we're working on them, but you didn't say very little about it. He said, Senator, you have never seen a headline in the Washington Post that reads, 2 million commuters made it safely to work today. But you have seen, and you will see many headlines, four people killed in a car crash on the highway. Good news is not news. Bad news is news. And our system is now, our political system is now increasingly geared to controversy, to sound bites, to slogans. And anybody who thinks you need time to consider, to study, to evaluate issues, you just don't get covered. That's just the harsh reality. I'm going to close with this. Remember the presidential nominating campaign of 2015 and 16. There were 12 or 13 Republican candidates, and they had them all lined up on the stage. And the debate rules were they had 60 seconds to answer a question and 30 seconds to respond. The system encourages bumper sticker slogans, catchy phrases, colorful language. Who can give a thoughtful answer to a serious international issue in 30 seconds? So it's a challenge that we all have, but it's very, very difficult to get the media to focus on it because their interest is, I don't mean to be critical of all of them, but their interest is in generating coverage, and controversy generates coverage. Thank you all very much. A great pleasure to be here with you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was George Mitchell, Maine's U.S. Senator from 1980 to 1995. He delivered the keynote address at the annual Mitchell Lecture on Sustainability, where he discusses the socioeconomic divisions here in Maine and across the country. If you missed part of the program or you want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock and Wait. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Roddy Nickpour. Thanks for joining us.